Why listen to the past when you can listen to the future? Welcome to the Think Future podcast, broadcasting from deep in the heart of Silicon Valley, California. We focus on innovation, startups, and the future, not necessarily those and not necessarily in that order. Here's your host.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So my name is Keith Keating. I've been in learning and development for about 20 years. I also consider myself a design thinking practitioner and a workforce futurist. So currently I work for a company called GP Strategies, which is a performance improvement company, a global company. But right now my main focus is on General Motors. So I lead what's called the Global Learning Network, looking to really create synergy between all the countries where General Motors operates, streamline, standardize, create efficiencies, while driving business performance, business improvement through the practice of learning and development.
Nice, nice, that's very cool. And how long have you done this for?
I've been with GM now for about, 4 years. So currently I'm in Detroit, Michigan. I moved here from Hong Kong. So it was a big culture shift, to say the least, but it's been interesting.
I was going to say, you used Zed instead of Z earlier, and I thought, is this guy from Canada? Because, I mean, I remember in Canada we used Zed, so I wasn't sure if you were from... I knew you were not from the States.
Yeah, so that's really from London. So I lived in London for about 5 years, supporting HSBC from an L&D perspective. But long story short, I grew up in Europe. So Germany, Korea... Well, Korea's not Europe, obviously, but started in Germany. And then Korea, Japan, all over.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. Very cool. So, I mean, I want to start to talk a little bit about L&D, because L&D, if you ask me, is kind of broken. And it's not just L&D. Education in general is broken. And it really needs help. It needs disruption. It needs to be fixed. Do you feel the same way, or am I like a lone voice in the wilderness?
100%. So I actually started a podcast myself about 7 weeks ago. And the idea was really around raising awareness for higher education, raising awareness for the future of work, but I didn't want to position it as the future of work. I positioned it and named it Ahead of Tomorrow, just to help start to discuss topics that get us prepared for tomorrow. And higher education is one of those. And my first episode was with my brother, who just graduated from University of Pennsylvania. $80,000 in debt, 4-year degree, can't get a job. So COVID, yes, has an impact on that. But even before COVID, the questions were, what type of certificates do you have? What type of experience do you have? And we're at that phase where no longer are degrees enough. Mm-hmm. And so that's one component. The other component is the pedagogy. In my opinion, an outdated system. So I'm actually in school now myself. I'm getting my doctorate from the University of Pennsylvania. And I have to be careful with how I say this, but it's helped reinforce there's a gap, a big disconnect between academia and the corporate world. Mm-hmm. And we're just not preparing students for the corporate world. Now, I will say there is one caveat. I don't know. Are you familiar with Minerva?
It sounds familiar, but I'm not 100% sure. Why don't you fill me in?
Yeah, so Minerva Schools was started by Ben Nelson, and he wanted to start it based off this discussion, the fact that higher education is broken. It's too expensive. It is not the equalizer. It is not preparing students. And so he created this university with that sole purpose, to prepare students for the real world. And it is phenomenal. I highly recommend it. The book is called Building the Intentional University. And it's all about the blueprint for how he designed Minerva, how he designed the pedagogy, how he brought in all of these phenomenal thinkers. Because at first, everyone said, no, you cannot create your own school. That's not possible. This is the system. But the system's broken. So what did he do? He went out and did it himself. And so I've spent time researching the institution, researching students that are there. And just to, it really classifies it itself as the higher education model for the 21st century learner. And so it in the 4 years, you actually study in 7 countries. So you spend each semester in a different country. Extremely affordable school. If you can't afford it, they will work with you to figure out how do we make this work. I think just off the top of my head, it might be $12,000 the first year or something like that. I mean, it's just nothing compared to what, you know, the top 10, top 20 universities are. So highly recommend explore that further. It's a really good model for the higher education system.
That's interesting.
Go ahead.
How does it leverage tech? I'm assuming it leverages a lot of technology. What else differentiates it?
Well, so first of all, they have their own custom platform. So they don't use Blackboard or Zoom or any of that. And the way that their platform is designed is to force engagement. So I'll give you a basic example. An instructor can't talk for more than 5 minutes without the technology kind of flashing to say, you need to stop speaking and allow that the synchronicity between the students. The breakout rooms, it can tell when the student has left the screen and done something else. It monitors eye contact. So it's really, really engaging from the technology perspective, but it also focuses on creating global students, creating opportunities that they wouldn't have otherwise had. And their whole motto is around making the city that you're in your education. So when you're spending the semester in the city, you're not there as a student. You are truly there as part of the city, working on local engagements. Their other motto is they don't have any tests. It's not about memorization, it's about application. And so rather than making you sit in a library and study for 20 hours a day, it's more about, we're gonna give you a project, you need to go out and apply that project and then come back and explain it to us and talk about how you've learned, talk about the methodologies and the pedagogy and other characteristics. For me,
fantastic. I love it.
I wish that I could go back. I guess I could get another undergrad, but it is what I would want for my kids or for myself. Mm.
And do they specialize in specific types of education, types of degrees?
So technically it's liberal arts, but mm-hmm. you get to design your area of focus. So if I remember the first 2 years, or maybe the first year, everybody has the same baseline core skill sets that they take or core curriculum. And then after that, you work with your main coach, your main facilitator on what is it that you want to learn? Where do you want to go? And then you create the next 2 or 3 years after that. Mm.
And it's accredited like all the others. So when I walk into a job with this degree, they're going to say, oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's accredited. So right now they're still working on their university accreditation, but it's Minerva Schools at like KGI or something like that. I can't remember the 3-letter acronym, but the answer is yes, it is accredited.
No, very cool. Very cool. Maybe I have a son who's going into Davis next year. So maybe UC Davis. So maybe I'll redirect him. I'll say, try this instead. You probably like this better.
I would at least check it out. So I'll send you the podcast after this. I just finished with a student who is there. And so she started at UCLA and she spent her first year at UCLA. And she said her breaking point was one night, it's midnight, she's in the library cramming to learn like the names of poets and all these other things. And she thought, this is arbitrary. I don't need to memorize names because we have Google. Like, you know, memorization is not an important part of our scholastic education anymore. So we've got to evolve past that. And I think that's the gap between higher ed and the 21st century learner is that it doesn't catch up quick enough. It's still, you know, you look back, it's the one system that has not evolved.
In
100 years. We still have that same model. You have desks and you have a teacher that stands at the front or now, you know, in a classroom online, but it just hasn't evolved past that yet.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, because I think what's happening is that we have to start assuming that we're going to have access to all this information all the time, right? It's just a base level thing. Everyone can look these things up. So why do we have to teach them? Why do you have to cram it into your head the way I put it is like we're already cyborgs, right? I mean, this device is basically our electronic part, right? And without this device, like it expands our minds and do we really need to have it in our heads? No. In fact, it's better that it's not in our heads, because then it doesn't clutter it up. And when we need it, it's right there. But if we don't need it, you know, it doesn't need to be there. So I think if we don't make that assumption that we're already, you know, going to have the technology, then we end up in situations like that, which are it's like old school thinking.
What we need to be focusing on are topics like news literacy, media literacy, information literacy. How do we analyze information correctly? Because to your point, we have it all in the palm of our hand. We've got, you know, information beyond what we can ever comprehend. What we need to now learn how to do is figure out, how do I interpret that? How do I critically think about that information? Rather than just being a passive consumer, I need to be an active consumer. I need to question the data that's in front of me. You know, it's, to me, it's not about whether it's Democrat, Republican, whether you're right, left, who cares what you are. It's about stepping back and asking, where did this data come from? Is it reliable? What are the sources? And then backtracking and then formulating your own ideas based on that. And I think that's one of the biggest gaps that we have right now, is that lack of critical thinking, especially right now with the political climate. It's just, it's no longer, we no longer have the ability to hold two opposing ideas in our head. It's either my idea or nothing. And then we create this confirmation bias. We create this echo chamber where we're just sharing the same information over and over again without even really researching it and understanding it. I was doing some research myself, and there was a study about 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I think, that maybe Stanford had done. And they took they took some sort of article, and the article had a headline, but in the body of the article, it was just lorem ipsum. It was just a bunch of garbage text. And so they published it, and it was forwarded 60,000 times. And so we had 60,000 plus people that didn't even bother to open it, but just kept that confirmation bias, that echo chamber bypass. That's all we do right now.
Yeah, yeah. And the tools are actually designed to do that, because it's very difficult to actually look at the copy and then share it. You share it before, it's all designed for sharing and nothing else. And that's why, you know, these clickbait headlines are ridiculous. But you're right, critical analytical thinking is something that needs to be taught, you know, in secondary, in high school. You need it like early on, and then that has to sort of color the rest of your education and your life, basically, because you need that, the ability to parse these things out, because I don't think it's being taught.
No, I don't remember. So I started researching it actually just about 6 or 8 months ago, because I started having aha moments and realizing, you know, I don't think I was ever taught this. I don't remember ever being asked or given the ability to have the permission to step back and question. And I think that's what we don't create, those opportunities, like for curiosity. Curiosity is one of the skill sets for the future of work, but it's a skill set we need now, not 10, 15 years down the road. And to have curiosity, we have to create the space for freedom and the space for failure and the space to be able to think for yourself. But we don't do that. And so to your point, yes, I think in grade school, we need it. We also need it in higher education, and we need it in our corporate education. We need to be teaching adults who didn't have that the ability that you do have this free space to think, to fail fast forward quickly and learn from it and move on. But we're just, for some reason, we're just not there yet.
Well, is it because, see, it's interesting you should mention that, because in both corporates and in regular education, it's a threat, though, isn't it? I mean, that kind of level of curiosity is like a threat to the system. It's a threat to the hierarchy. It's a threat to established norms. I mean, how do you break out of that?
I think we're slowly starting to, with the word disruption. You know, everybody's a disruptor now. Everything's disruption.
Well, it's like people like disruption until they get disrupted. Then they're like, oh my God, we hate disruption.
Oh, you're a disruptor? That's so great. That's like workforce futurist. You know, now you, I would attribute our workforce futurist, but I'm seeing everybody now on LinkedIn. That's the new catchphrase. You know, we're all workforce futurists. We're all disruptors, but there is a lot of positivity behind embracing the idea of disruption. And that's one of the reasons that I love design thinking, is that it gives you this space, if you understand it, to disrupt. And it might be in a bit of a silo microcosm, but it does teach you about creativity, about curiosity. And you already know going into it that you're going to fail. That's the idea behind design thinking, behind being agile. And so I think the more that larger organizations start to embrace design thinking and truly understand what it is, rather than just a catchphrase or the new hot buzz term, because I find too that, oh, you know, come in, teach us design thinking. And then the first question is, what am I going to get out of this? You know, what's the ROI on this? Well, we don't know yet. We haven't gone through it. Oh, then no, that's okay. Thanks. We'll do something else. I want to know going in how much money we're going to make on this or how much we're going to save on this. So
I'm having flashbacks to every ideation session I ever had. That's exactly, it's like ROI is the very first thing that they ask about. I'm like, ROI, we don't even know what's coming out of this. Yes. Could be anything.
We don't know what it is right. Yet.
Exactly.
So I think the design thinking and embracing concepts like that, UX, all of the letter X designs will help. But I think that the more stories of failure and the more that we embrace those stories of failure are very powerful. So when I talk about design thinking, I bring up Kodak, BlackBerry, Blockbuster, you know, all major organizations that just couldn't recognize that they needed to change. They didn't accept disruption. I mean, one of my favorite examples is Kodak had the first digital camera. I think it was the late 70s they had it. And they specifically said, no, this is going to go against what we do. This is going to ruin film industry. So let's not do it.
They invented digital photography, but then they suppressed it.
Yes.
That's exactly right. But you think it's interesting that you talk about design thinking, because design thinking has so many definitions, if you ask me. And one is, you know, you bring the customers into the conversation, and then you do the design thinking and the iterations, the artifact creation and stuff like that. And I personally think that design thinking sometimes is disruptive because you're basically just listening to the customers. Right? And things like the iPhone and other things that were just sort of built in secret and then released. And it's like, wow, this is great. Because, you know, Steve Jobs famously said, you know, you can't listen to customers. They don't know what they want. We have to tell them what they want. So how do you see design thinking and disruption coming together like that?
So, it's interesting that you brought up the Steve Jobs quote, because I've always been a little bit confused by that. Depends on how in one research is like, yes, don't ask customers. But then the other, they're the first big proponent of design thinking. So what is it? Either did you ask customers or did you not ask customers?
Right. You asked them, but you didn't, right?
Right. So my focus is more on the L&D space. I know that design thinking has its clout from, of course, Stanford, IDEO, Apple, all product driven. When I was introduced to it about 4 or 5 years ago, I had an aha moment. I studied it at MIT and I thought, okay, you know, for product design, of course, this is great. I get it, but I'm not in the product space. However, I'm in the human capital space. I'm in the people space. And that's immediately what I saw design thinking as, is a tool. Whenever you are working with people, it is a framework, a methodology that you can consider using to help understand your people better. And so for L&D, I can't think of an instance where you wouldn't want to use it with your customers. So I use it for two purposes, continuous improvement. So anytime that I'm working with a client or a customer and things are good and I want to push the boundaries to go further, like could we be better? Then empathy research is the best way to help us figure out could we be even better. And the other is in general with L&D programs. What I find is in the L&D space, we have been predominantly order takers. So our business partners come to us and they tell us what they want. I want a 2-day instructor-led training. I want a 30-minute web-based training. You know, create a PDF on this. And historically, we've executed that. We give it to them. They go off. 6 months later, the project failed. It didn't change the behavior. And they come back and they say, well, your program didn't work. You know, why? Well, we didn't know anything about it. We didn't do any analysis. No one asked the learners, what do you need? How can we help you? And for me, that's what design thinking does. When my business partner gives me an order, I use design thinking almost as my shield to take a step back and to ask my customers, you know, I hear your request, but let's understand what the learners need. Let's understand what their behavior is that they're trying to change and maybe how we got here. And let's just understand them first. we may come right back to the exact request, or we may uncover this isn't a learning request at all. It could be a process issue. It could be a platform issue. More often than not, L&D, we get those orders, we execute them, and then it turns out it wasn't even a learning challenge, but then we get all the blame for it in the end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you always get the blame. You know what it's like.
Well, it's so, development. It's your fault.
So I love the, this is the $64,000 question with L&D is, how do you make these things stick? Because that's the biggest complaint about any of the training that you do is that, you know, people go through the course and then, you know, weeks later, they're like, eh, you know, forgotten everything. Right. So how do you make it stick? Is it because you use design thinking, or how do you make these things stick?
So I think there's a multi-pronged approach. I think you've got your pre-setup, your actual initiative, and then your post. For me, learning doesn't stop when you leave the classroom or you leave that instance, web-based training, whatever it is. I'm a big proponent of being a lifelong learner. And I think that is one of the biggest gifts that we can give to all of our learners, especially in terms of the future of work. You know, one thing I'm passionate about right now is help coaching people, including myself, to evolve from using the phrase future-proof. What I see in L&D and for futurists is, oh, we're going to help everybody future-proof themselves. Well, there's no way we can do that. I cannot. There's nothing I can give you that is going to guarantee your job, guarantee your career in the future. I mean, 6 months ago, if I had told the 30 million people in the U.S., hey, I'm going to future-proof you, but then COVID hit, they all have no jobs now. They're coming after me.
Yeah. Yep.
So yep. What we can do is we can future prepare or future ready. And so being a lifelong learner is how I like to future prepare anyone. And you know, the concept of being a learner has shifted. It used to be you go to school or you get your trade school, you get your education, and then you get your job and you do your job and you get your pension and you retire. That no longer exists. Now we need to learn, unlearn, relearn. Learn, unlearn, relearn, learn, unlearn, relearn. And that continues throughout our entire career. No matter what stage of the career that you're in, it's like a nonstop conveyor belt. You've got to keep moving and learning no matter where you are. And so to answer your question, you know, how do we make learning stick? One, the mindset of being a lifelong learner. So it's not an event, it's a continuous activity. The other is context. We have got to include context in learning initiatives. Context is really what shapes learning. It's what makes it relevant. It's what makes it meaningful to me. If you're going to sit me in a classroom for 4 hours, it's got to resonate with me. Is my mic okay?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay, just checking. it's got to resonate with me. I have to understand what it is, where I'm going, but I also have to be supported. I need to be supported by my manager. So managers play a role in the success of learning and development initiatives. You can't just send your people and not engage with them afterwards. So context, relevance, and reflection. We have got to give our learners the opportunities to reflect on what they're learning, to take it back into their real-world work environment so that they can apply it and recognize and be able to change their behavior, change their performance. And so, long story short, it is context, relevance, reflection with the mindset of being a lifelong learner.
Right. And is that what you teach in most of your courses, or you just get to that point and then they're moving on their own?
So I think it's both. I'm an advocate of all of those. And so what's the word that's thrown around? Evangelist. So I'm an evangelist for all of those. And teach them both in classroom, but I also speak on them, write on them. And that's my focus for the future of work. So I think every workforce futurist has sort of a different angle. Mine is really that human angle. I understand and recognize that automation, robotics, technology will play a huge part in the future. You know, we're starting to see that now. But they're going to augment us. It's going to work beside us, freeing us up to do what we do best. And so in order for that to happen successfully, we have to prepare the talent to recognize what they actually do best, what those higher order cognitive skills are. And so that lifelong learner mentality really helps reinforce that. So we're constantly revisiting that. And it helps us be agile, adaptable, and resilient, because the truth is, we have no idea what the future is going to hold. I don't know what jobs are going to be available in the next 5 or 10 years, just like we didn't know the ones 10 years ago. When I was growing up, you know, the jobs that you wanted to be were teacher, doctor, lawyer. You know, 10 years ago, it was a YouTube video analyzer, a video game player. Now people want to be a Kardashian. You know, these are real jobs. Right. Real jobs that people are making money on. And so in 5 or 10 years, it's going to be new jobs that we don't even know what they are. So what we can do, though, is help people prepare by being agile, adaptable, resilient, embracing change so that they can move with the organizations. Seth Godin is one of my favorite authors. And I don't know if you read Lynchpin or not, but you know, that resonated with me so much. Because that's how I built my career, is looking for gaps in organizations and just figuring out how to do it. I'm not smarter than anybody else. I don't have a better education than anybody else. I just look for areas where people say, that's not my job. I don't want to do that. Or I don't know how to do that. And I say, okay, well, let me figure out how to do it. And I do it. And I continue growing on that way. And that's what, for me, I want for everyone in the workforce, so that they don't have to live in fear about the future of their job. And right now we live in a fear-based economy. Mm-hmm. And you know, even before COVID, you know, what really turned me on first to the future of work was the headlines, the spurious headlines. 73 million jobs are gonna be lost. 800 million jobs are gonna be lost. Robots will steal your job and you're not prepared for it. I started seeing these and I thought, like, is this a joke? Like, is this, like, how could this even be realistic? How do you know? And that's what started me on the critical thinking, was I started looking at their data, like, where did you get 800 million? What type of study could you possibly have done that says 800 million people are going to lose their jobs? And then I realized that no one knows.
Yeah.
And the media is picking up on these little data points. Like, one of my favorite is the McKinsey report. And I think it was on page 114 of their first report. And on page, on 114, on one side, it said 73 million jobs may be at risk. On the other page, it said up to 86 million jobs may be created. So it was like a net surplus of 13 million jobs. So the headline should have been, in the future of work, we're going to have so many jobs, we don't have enough people to fill it. Instead, what the media picked up on is 73 million jobs may be at risk. Why? Because that's sexier. That's scary. Yeah. People are going to click on that. That's going to sell more. It's, you know, the hopeful side of the future isn't sexy. It's not clickbait. And so we continuously perpetuate all this fear. And that's really what drove me to, I want to help change this. I want to help reiterate the positive side of this and identify ways that we can prepare people for that future. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, I'm totally into resilience. I think resilience is the thing that people forget about, and you need to be personally resilient, right? It's not, you can't expect your company to you know, your company can be resilient, but you also have to be resilient, because especially I'm an independent consultant. I know people who have full-time jobs and they're like, I'm never going to be an independent consultant. That's too crazy. Anything could happen. Like, you're probably seeing more disruption than I am. You know, you're probably seeing in a regular, you know, you got mergers and acquisitions, you've got, you know, companies divesting. There's so much going on in the regular employee space that this might even be calmer. So resilience is something I've talked about for the longest time. And it's something that I think one of these things that, you know, people who there's like planning on one side and there's resilience on the other. Right. And the planning is great, but then there's a black swan, which like destroys everything, kind of like what happened with COVID. So if you have the resilience down, then anything that comes along, you'd be able to get through. So it's absolutely right. And when you're talking about jobs, I mean, I know futurist Thomas Frey, you probably heard of him. He was talking about autonomous vehicles eliminating 2 billion jobs. And then he explains it by saying, well, first there's the, you know, there's the mechanics, and then there's the gas stations, and there's this, like, if you do extend it all the way out, it's a massive problem. But the thing is, it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen it's going to happen in pockets, and it's going to give people time to be able to build something else. I think if you figure out autonomous vehicles and eliminate Uber drivers, I think that's a good thing, because human beings are way more effective mm-hmm. as something other than drivers. I mean, human beings have more to provide than just driving a car. And there was something else I said.
We don't teach that. The education system, going back kind of full circle here, was created to establish the manufacturing industry, to mm-hmm. create people so that they go and they do their job and they do what they need to do for that function. And then it wasn't designed to teach people how to think.
Yep.
And that's exactly. The idea that we've got right now. And I love the Hello Future, Forge Your Ideal Future concept. I love that, because that's what I want for people in general. Yep. Is recognize that you can be more. When we think about the future of work, one of the biggest challenges is people don't know what's going to be available to them, because they don't know inherently themselves. They don't know their uniqueness. They don't know their skill sets, because we don't embrace and teach that enough. And I think, going again full circle to your point, a lot of education systems and corporations don't want to teach that. They don't want people asking the question, is this job for me? Is this really what I was meant to do? Was I meant to sit behind this desk for 10 hours a day and do this for the next 20 years? Probably not, but that is what that company needs from you.
Yep.
So it's a TPS report.
We get that TPS report. Make sure you get the right cover on the TPS report. that movie was so prescient. I loved it. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no. It absolutely was. And forge your ideal future. That's really what we should want for everybody. And mm-hmm. that's what I'm passionate about. And that's why I focus on, in the future of work and approaching it from dispelling the fear side and focusing more on the higher order cognitive side and just being the lifelong learner. Barry O'Reilly published a book recently called Unlearn that I highly recommend. And he's focusing on that concept that organizations and leaders need to recognize that you need to be able to unlearn before you can continue to grow and develop. And it's like if you had a teacup and you had poured tea in it, but the teacup got full, any additional ideas are just going to spill out. So you've got to continuously be emptying that, unlearning it to be able to refill that. And it's a gift that we can give to ourselves by embracing that concept of unlearning, embracing the concept of being a lifelong learner.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, my concept of the future work is very similar to what you're talking about, is that, I mean, I've already heard this a couple times, is that companies are going to become like a bit like Uber, where you have senior management up here, you have algorithms in the middle, and then you have the worker at the bottom. And the worker doesn't necessarily need to be a human. It could be a machine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, eventually I'm thinking to myself, well, why do we even really need these people at the top, right? It's like the entire thing could just be programmed to make money. Right. And then everybody is just like a worker, which is who can come on board and off board whenever they need to work. And then they could take jobs from different companies. And it's just like a huge pool of jobs. And I think at some point, that's what we're going to see, is that there's going to be this giant system which sort of dispatches. It takes in jobs and then it dispatches tasks to people. So it's like, mm-hmm. oh, you happen to be walking by that park. Well, why don't you sweep up the park and it will pay you like $50 or whatever. And so it'll be just in time jobs, just in time learning, just in time all the stuff, and it'll all be either run by some giant algorithm or a set of algorithms. And that's what work will become. It'll become sort of, it won't be a monolithic thing that we just go to and come back from. It's going to be like a little here, a little here, a little here, sort of mashed in with your life. Kind of what we're experiencing now today, right? Today we're experiencing that sort of thing where you might have an hourly meeting and then you have to go run an errand or something like that. So you don't have that monolithic concept anymore. And I think all of our institutions and all of our corporations are still stuck in that like a monolithic thing when they think about work. I mean, do you see the same thing happening?
Absolutely. You know, I'm thinking about staffing.com or TopTal is their parent company as an example. And I think the gig economy is a big part of the future, and where, you know, we talk about continuous learning. I think from a work perspective, it's going to be kind of a continuous work, not that you're working 24, but that you have access to it 24 hours a day. Like to your point, if you're walking past something, an alert pops up, hey, I could go do that and make a few dollars for it. You know, you shared a few minutes ago that someone had said to you, you know, why do you want to be a consultant? You know, that's so disruptive. And my mindset, and I don't know if it's generational, but I've never trusted that I'm safe in an organization. And I'm thankful for that. And maybe that was because I got fired a lot in my first few jobs, you know, whether it be downsizing or just bad performance. But after you go through, I would say, you know, being fired 3 or 4 times or laid off, you recognize, and for me, I embraced, I'm not safe. And that's not a bad thing. For me, that's it gives me an awareness, I think, that a lot of people don't have, because there's this false sense of security that, well, I work for a big organization, they're never going to lay me off, so I can be complacent and I can be complicit and I don't have to continuously grow and develop. And that's a mindset that puts people at risk. And again, going back, being a lifelong learner, because if you're focusing on resiliency, agility, adaptability, lifelong learning, when you do lose that job, you're okay. Because you know that you have transferable skills that you'll be able to take on someplace else. And so that's something else I'm passionate about helping people recognize, is their transferable skills. Because to your point about the future or current gig economy, the reason that that works is because we're also a skills-based economy. But in order for that to work, you have to know what your skills are. And your skills are not your job title. And too many people put so much emphasis and weight on that job title, as if calling myself a senior vice president somehow gives me some sort of clout or some sort of skill set that the next person doesn't have. Anybody can call themselves that. Every banker is a vice president of something.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It doesn't mean anything.
It's the thing that they give out when they don't have budget for salary increases. It's meaningless. Titles are meaningless. Absolutely. Now.
But your skill set is where the meaning comes in. And so going back to that conversation about higher education, for me, it is more important for the practical application that people have had in a job, understanding their skill sets, than it is for your degree. I honestly don't care where you got your degree from, or if you have a degree, if you can come in and show me that you have the aptitude, show me that you have the skill set and the experience, whether it's actually job experience or volunteer experience or whatever it is, or you come in and you talk about transferable skills, you're able to recognize, hey, this is what you're looking for, and I haven't done it maybe in that specific case, but I did do something similar here, and here's how it translates. That power that you have behind that is what is going to future prepare you when you do lose your job, when you are looking for that career shift. Because the other thing about the fact that we aren't stable, we don't have career longevity, we also don't have, we're going to shift careers. And I think that scares a lot of people. They don't recognize or understand how they can shift careers. They think, well, I've only been in automotive. I've only worked in a bank. I've only been a retail sales clerk. And those are the people that I want to help. The I don't know the right descriptor, but I'll just say a different way, like retail sales workers, truck drivers. When I look at retail sales workers, they're at the highest risk in the future. We've already seen it with the self-checkout lanes. We know that's the future, although self-checkout lanes are deplorable. They, you know, the line I find is even longer there. But nonetheless, you know, retail is...
It's like people don't like working with people. I think that's what it is. I think people would prefer... It's kind of like when you, like, I'd rather talk to a chatbot than a human when I dial in, because I know that a chatbot is a chatbot and they're not going to try and strong arm me into some new product or whatever. It's like people, I think people have gotten to the point where they trust humans less than they do machines. So that's probably why they prefer, even if the line is longer over at the self-check, is that at least they know that, you know, this person's not going to be slow or blah, blah, blah. It's like they don't have to deal with the human. So I have a blog post a while back that I wrote. It's like, can you improve customer service by removing the human from the equation? And I think some people believe that. But sorry, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's an interesting point. When I think about the retail sales worker, though, when I'm doing empathy research with them, oftentimes they already start to belittle themselves with their job title. Like, hey, what do you do? Oh, I'm just a clerk at Target. Well, you're not just a clerk. You've got customer service skills. You've probably got some computer skills. You have problem solving skills. So those are three skill sets that can transfer to a whole host of other industries. But that's not the way that people are taught to think. They're not taught that I don't have to fit inside of this little box called a retail sales worker. And we inherently have bias already. I mean, as soon as you meet somebody and they say, hey, I work at Walmart, you've already you think you're probably married, kids, didn't finish college, maybe didn't finish high school. We're creating this whole story behind these individuals and pushing them down rather than helping them embracing what they do, because first of all, those jobs are needed, but seeing that they can be beyond that. And so that's really what I'm passionate about, is helping people recognize the transferable skill sets that they have, because they do have them, and it can transfer to other areas, to these new jobs that we don't even know what they are. So to your point, you know, technology does destroy jobs. Absolutely. But it creates jobs. It creates jobs that we can't even fathom existing right now. And that's what we've got to be preparing people for, are those jobs that we don't even know what they are yet.
Yeah. Well, I did some work for Walmart, and they always ask me what location. I'm like, the head office, you know, I was running their innovation program. But it's interesting you should mention that, because the flip side of that is the whole talent management recruiting process. That's also broken, right? Because people don't hire for those kind of things. They hire for, like, oh, is this guy's resume good? Does he interview well? You know, it's like, you know, I'm a big advocate of using it, like going back to apprenticing, right? Mm-hmm. How are you going to know how someone's going to work with you unless you actually have them work with you, right? Yes. So give them like a 2-week trial period, see how it works out. And anytime within that 2-week trial period, both of you can say, you know, this is not working out, I'm out of here. But how do you know if the right person, if you've got the right person for the job, you know, during an hour long interview, even if you have a panel interview, you have all these people, the guy could just present well. The resume might be awesome, but in reality, it doesn't work. So, you know, I think there's problems on the educational side where people, yes, definitely need to be lifelong learners and take command of their own education and be resilient against these things. But at the same time, the whole sort of talent acquisition industry needs to be upended and fixed, because you've got all these great qualified people that are not getting through to the right jobs. And you get all these hiring managers going, why did I hire this person? He's no good. And, you know, there's something wrong in that match too. So are you seeing that too?
Absolutely. Especially in, you know, the recruiting process. In fact, I was reading an article recently that, so first of all, massive bias in recruiting. And I think that's one of the challenges too with focusing on AI. I understand that we're trying to speed up the process of, you know, whittling through the thousands of respondents, but we're losing a lot of good opportunities. Now, what's interesting is I was reading that some of the bugs that they're catching is on individual CV, they will, let's say the background is white, they will put code words embedded in there in white so the human eye doesn't catch it, like Harvard, Oxford, Yale. And so when you or I read the CV, you say, okay, they went to the University of Pennsylvania, but the AI is actually looking for higher education beyond that. And so people are getting pulled into interviews.
Nice.
Because they're using the hidden space that's in there. So significant bias in the recruiting process. But I've also experienced the same. You know, you hire somebody, they're a good interviewer. I'm a terrible interviewer. I get nervous. And especially when there's panels, like six people sitting in front of you or back to back to back to back, you're exhausted and people are making all of these decisions on you. I think it's about relationship. It's about that human synergy. And I do appreciate LinkedIn for that, because if you make the effort to build those relationships, networking can be a very powerful tool through LinkedIn. On the flip side, I think that the recruiting part of LinkedIn, or, you know, I'll just share with you, last year, just for giggles, I applied for over 100 jobs through LinkedIn just by clicking, you know, apply and fill out some things. Mm-hmm. I got zero responses, not one single response. And I thought, well, first of all, I'm glad I'm not looking for a job because that's really scary. There was a moment where I thought, well, what's wrong with me? Am I not employable? And I spent some time talking to Paul Estes, who you might know from Microsoft, now works at staffing.com as their editor-in-chief. And he said, well, you know, you and I are in this unique class. We're not really employable. We're not, you can't quantify what we do. You can't slap a job title on us. And I hope that more and more people are like that, because I don't resonate with my job title. I don't fit in that box, and I don't want to fit in that box. I want to be able to be adaptable, agile to whatever the need is. On the flip side, LinkedIn doesn't recognize that as a value, and LinkedIn doesn't know what to do with me. And so people like that are at risk for not being able to get jobs through that traditional way. And so that's why
we end up being independent consultants, because we're no longer employable as an employee, but as a consultant, the knowledge is phenomenal, right? Because you have all this different knowledge from different places. So it's almost like, you know, once you hit a certain level of experience, it's not age, it's a certain level of experience, a certain level of education, people don't want you as an employee because they want you to fit in that box. And it's like, why doesn't a company turn around and say, you know what, we don't want people to fit in boxes. We want people to expand to fill the space, not fit in the little box. So the employers themselves really need to look at each individual and go, you know what, this person would be a quality hire for my company, not just necessarily for this space.
That's, to me, the future of work. That's the future of hiring. When we look at corporations that are going to be successful in the next 10 to 15 years, they're the ones that get that. And I think, you know, historically, Apple has been a bit of a proponent of that, at least from a marketing perspective. I think, you know, one of the Jobs quotes was, I don't hire people to tell them what to do. You know, I hire smart people so that they can tell us what to do. Or I'm botching that horribly, but the sentiment is still there. So I think, you know, Silicon Valley may be the area that gets that, although I think it's shifting now a little bit more, where we're starting to put people more in boxes. You know, what's interesting is that when I do work with clients as a consultant, they're saying, well, why didn't we hire you? Well, because your recruitment system rejects me. It's, you know, I can go through the recruitment system for the same companies I consult with that want to hire me through the relationship channel, but I cannot get recognized through the recruitment channel. It is broken. And it's the companies that are suffering from an innovation standpoint, from an evolution standpoint, and that's going to be a bit of their downfall.
Yeah. Well, it kind of leads me back to Chris Christensen's jobs to be done theory, right? I mean, if you read this thing in depth, it basically says you need to change your business model to conform with what the customer wants. Mm-hmm. So if the customer wants to buy a home, they don't want a mortgage. They want to buy a home, but the bank provides a mortgage, right? So like there's a mismatch between what we do and what our customer wants. And so many companies don't make that transition to realize, you know, these got to come together for it to happen. And it's the same thing with all these matching, whether it's, you know, learning or whether it's talent, you know, you've got to pull these things together in such a way that they'll meet. And there's so much resistance to keeping them from meeting. And that's what I think that's what's holding us back.
That's a great use case though for design thinking, is helping to identify those gaps between what the business wants and what the customer wants.
Yeah.
You know, for going back to L&D for a minute, one of the challenges for our space is that we're known as the providers of learning. In fact, I've heard some people even call us the owners of learning. But as an L&D professional, I don't want to be the owner of your learning. I don't want that responsibility on my shoulders. What I want to be is an enabler. I want to enable you and empower and encourage you to take control over your future so that you can have access to that learning. You can have access to those ideas to continue to grow and develop rather than it being a single place that you go to, a single activity. And so I think the L&D industry needs to evolve. We've got to evolve from being the providers of learning, content creators. We need to be content curators, and we need to be enablers of learning.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And with that note, we're out of time. It was great talking with you. We got to do this again because there's so many more topics I'd love to be able to cover with you. So why don't you tell people how to get in touch with you?
LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the best way. I'm highly active on there. Love having conversations and meaningful conversations, you know, either between posts, sharing comments, taking it offline. So please feel free to reach out to me, Keith Keating on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, if you could send me your bio, I'll drop it in the comments below we'll go from there. Oh, thank you so much, sir. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really good talking with you.
All right.